This is Lauren Bond, and welcome to Dub Labs Out There. Imagine a soundscape that not only stimulates your auditory senses, but also connects us with the more than human world. Metabolic Sonic's groundbreaking practice, in which we have literally broken through the concrete of the LA River, fuses the machine with the biological.
My great uncle Ray, he was our absolute freedom fighter and a total just river warrior. He never learned to read or write, but he was a hardcore freedom fighter. He fished and he knew our river better than probably anyone of his generation. And he was arrested 19 times by the state of California just for fishing on the Yurok Reservation where his ancestors did. 19 times, you know? So that's where that quote, or that, you know, those words come from, was from reflecting on his experience. You know, he was fishing on the Yurok Reservation. We, as the Yurok tribe, have always had federally reserved rights to fish there, which means like the state can regulate those and the tribe can. But they're vested good rights. But the state had passed, California passed a law in 1930 that banned all Yuroks from fishing on the Klamath River. Only Yurok people. Yeah. And that was like making breathing illegal for us. You know, because fishing, that's how critical it is to our whole way of life. And they knew what they were doing. You know, they were trying to criminalize our way of life. But Uncle Ray, he kept fishing, and so 19 times he got arrested. But here's the cool thing, is so the 19th time he goes to the state superior county court up in Arcata, California, and the judge by this point knows him. And it's like, okay, Ray, you know, give me a dollar, I'll drop the charges and you can get your nets back. And Uncle Ray, you know, pounds the table and says, I have Indian rights and I'm gonna prove it. And that was 1969. And so, you know, the rest of the country is sending a man to the moon at Woodstock, but also what was happening was from sort of an output of the civil rights movement was the formation of the California Indian Legal Services up in Berkeley. And so the family connected with them, and finally we had lawyers, and he pushed his case all the way to the Supreme Court, and there the court held that the Yurok Reservation was still Indian country, and we had our fishing rights, our inherent sovereignty, and the state had no business regulating our fishing. And so then, you know, coming back, like, I'm going through law school, and I'm learning about these cases, and I had heard about them growing up, but in law school, I'm learning them in the context of the law and the precedent, and then getting to actually assert those rights. And what was really powerful is Uncle Ray's case, it's called Matz versus Arnett, that was really the legal foundation for the argument that the tribal rights demanded dam removal because the dams were blocking the fish from passing, which was harming the fishery. And the salmon runs were about 3 to 5% of their historical size because of all of this. So clearly that was harming our fishing rights. And so the empowering part was, you know, being able to assert these really powerful rights that my family had helped establish.
Yeah, you brought up two really important things, both of which I want to touch on. So if you see me noting over here, that's not fake drawing or anything.
I was hoping it was art.
Yeah, I'm like... No, I think it's something like when we talk about, you know, you mentioned an elder, intergenerational. The three of us are mothers and caregivers. We work with youth in different capacities. So I'm wondering, how do we have these conversations with complex issues and kids and really just anyone? You know, you mentioned that your 10-year-old son is here, and it's, yeah.
What's up, Keen?
I mean, that's what I love about natives is we're like, the kids have to be involved. And I know other people of other backgrounds feel the same way, but I think, how do we start with that? And Lauren, you having two kids yourself, what has worked when you've been talking about complex issues with our water, with our earth, politics, art, whatever it may be?
Yeah, great question. Well, first of all, I wanted to draw attention to these little creatures here. These are made not by my kids, but by middle schoolers at Anahuaca Mecac. Marcos Aguilar's here tonight, and in many traditional cultures, children are guardians of the web. So what's worked for me in thinking about reconnecting and remembering broken epistemological connections that lie almost deep in the very core of being human is our relationship. We all have a relationship with water. We all came from a mother's body. We all lived in water before we came out of water. It's fundamental to, I think, all humans and also many animals, most animals. But what really has worked for me is to see the light go on in young people's eyes when their hands are touching clay and the prompt is, let's make guardians of the well. Let's take care of this precious thing. Let's make, using clay, which is water and, you know, the living material of everything that has decayed in the ground. So all of this is made out of clay that has been dug out of the ground here on this site. And what Marcos and the teachers at Anahuaca Mecac were encouraging the children to do was to play with the concept of being a guardian of the water. And so what I learned from that is that very achievable, tangible, touch-based practice of creating likeness is a way back home. So maybe that's true for artists as a way to reconnect, but sometimes touch can do things that language can't, especially when the meaning behind language has been lost.
For me, there's a few layers to that. The first is that, so I was general counsel for the Yurok tribe for some time, and then in 2020, I was pregnant with my third baby, and it was COVID, and the river was also very sick, and there was mass infections of the baby salmon in the river, which was awful for so many reasons. But also the dam removal agreement was on the rocks, and so I started talking with the Yurok Council about changing my role with the tribe to just focus on the river. And that resulted in co-founding the Ridges to Riffles Indigenous Conservation Group with, and I co-founded it with this awesome Karuk woman who was a leader of the grassroots effort for dam removal. But the idea there is we wanted to move money and power and organize in different ways to get a different outcome. My dad has this saying, and it is, you can't keep putting your hand in the mousetrap over and over again and expect a different outcome. Right? Yeah. I love this. And I think it just highlights this point so well. Like, we can't keep just sort of doing things the same way, managing the same way, you know, all doing things the same way and expect different outcomes. So applying that to the river, you know, we co-founded this nonprofit, and one of the core values there is that tribal sovereignty starts at home. And, you know, so if I was going to be this lawyer, if we were going to be advocates, you know, advocating for our culture, we also have to make sure that we are raising our babies in good ways so that they are healthy humans to then live out and enjoy this culture that we've worked so hard to protect. And so, you know, that is very much a value. And what I would say from that is I think in facilitating these conversations with the youth, there's a personal responsibility to try to make sure you as an adult are in balance, right? You know, as adults, we have all the distractions, we have all the trauma, all the things, but I think it's really important, and this is one of the things that the river showed me, was like watching it heal. I had this profound moment of, if my ancient relative, this beautiful, powerful river can heal, I owe it to the creator to also heal and to live well, you know? Yeah, and it means saying no to, you know, other positions or whatever that don't align with that value of balance. And so being at Ridges to Riffles has allowed me to, you know, not, and of course no one's perfect, and so sometimes things are rugged, but it has gotten me more into balance, and so I think that's important, because then you can approach your kids or whoever you're working with from a much more grounded place. But then the second thing too is out at Yurok, and we're lucky in the sense that we're still on our river. And so teaching the kids is about having them on the river and experiencing it. That's how I was raised, is we would just go to the river and you would fish, you would play, you would just play in the dirt, whatever it is. And through that, especially during fishing season, you know, there's all kinds of families that are on the river. And so people would come to your camp and sit around the fire and tell fish stories. And that is literally the source of this book. and that's how I heard all these amazing stories of, you know, Uncle Ray, and the flip side of like Uncle Ray being arrested 19 times was he had these amazing stories of outrunning, you know, the game wardens. Yeah, and so we'd be sitting around the campfire and hearing these, and my whole life I was just sort of blown away by this. And so that is how we try to teach our kids, is by being there in the place. And of course, the river speaks for itself, you know? And so just being there, it talks to you. And what we try to do is, you know, like bring the kids there, but then also teach them to listen. But also, I took that ideology and tried to write the book that way as best I could. And in the intro, you know, I say, like, this is my invitation to all my readers to come to the river, you know, sit by the campfire, and I'll tell you all these stories. You know, and the language I use, it's not perfect English. And I told my editor, like, you know, I'm gonna have run-on sentences, y'all. Like, and you know, we came to an agreement. It's all good. But it's written in a way that reflects the language that's used in my community, because I wanted to offer people that authentic experience as much as I possibly could of coming to the river and hearing how the people talk and how we talked about these stories.
I love that. Thank you.
I just wanted to say how much I also enjoyed on your Audible, the interviews that you did with your grandmother. So if anybody uses Audible, you know, Amy does give that feeling like you can feel like you're around the campfire with her. So, and I thought that that really carried. I wanted to just like uplift one thing about that, which is when I started my work with the river, it was indirect, but one thing that was interesting to me is how official narratives of place did not accept spoken word as real history. So when I went to the California State Parks in 2005 and asked them if I could clean up the abandoned train yard, which is across the street from here, which will be the spreading ground of the liberated river, God willing, the idea I had was to use corn that has been often cultivated to pull toxicity out of the ground. And I had spoken to many people, elders in this area, about a time when the river still flooded here and something very like corn would grow. So I got that idea through talking to people. It wasn't, you know, especially not being from here, it was through conversation. And so when I went to the state park, I said, could you grow a cornfield here? And they said, well, we like the idea of you cleaning up the train yard, but we can't call it a cornfield because there's no historic proof that anything like corn was ever grown there. And I said, well, here's the audio files. And I played them, the tribal elders talking about corn. And they said, well, if it's not written, it's not history. So the, you know, the importance of listening to your elders and writing a book is not only that you were able to be present and be trustable, but now it is actually, not only is it history because of the law of precedent, yeah, but it's history because you put their stories into print.
Thank you both. I believe we're at time here, even though I could go on and on and on. But shout out to women. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.